Well, it's wonderful to be here today and sit with you. And it's lovely to see some of you haven't been here for a while. So it's great that you're able to be here. So happy to sit with you. Let me just say that just before the end of the last sitting period, we had some kind of Wi-Fi issue. So I don't know what happened to the screen, but originally when that would happen, Zoom would just shut down. Now it keeps the meeting going even if the host disappears. So I was able to get back in, but I'm going to have to get the cable next time and have that hooked up. There seems to be something wrong with the Wi-Fi here in this building. So hang on to your hats. If suddenly I freeze, hang in there. I'll be back. I'll finish the sentence, you know. Okay, so today's Teisho is on case 20 in the Book of Serenity. Case 20 is entitled Dizhang's Nearness. Introduction: the profound talk entering into Nunanon decides three and weeds out four. The great way to the capital goes seven ways across and eight ways up and down. Suddenly, if you can open your mouth and fully explain, take steps and walk, then you can hang your bowl and bag up high and break your staff. But tell me, who is this? Dizhang asked Feiyan, where are you going? Feiyan said, around on a pilgrimage. Dizhang said, what's the purpose of the pilgrimage? Feiyan said, I don't know. Dizhang said, not knowing is nearest. Verse. Now, having studied to the full, it's like before. Having shed entirely the finest thread, he reaches not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long. Stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes where his feet take him. The purpose of 10 years pilgrimage, clearly, he'd turned his back on one pair of eyebrows. So, you know, this week we've had many events in the world which are, you know, heartrending, painful, difficult, horrifying, all of the above. You know, as we speak, people are dying. It's very likely people are dying in terrible ways. This is one of those moments where I think it becomes obvious that our ordinary reality is seriously defective, right? I mean, we live in a world of like a collective fantasy. It's a kind of a collective dream, right? I mean, it's true that there are constraints on the collective dream. You know, if you don't put gas in your car, it won't go, right? But all the same, we live in a kind of a collective dream. And we grow up learning how to accept this dream as real. And, you know, children sometimes don't. You know, they might think, why do I have to go to school? Why do I have to do this, right? And gradually, you know, they're answered or not answered, and we learn to accept this reality, and we learn to trust it, and we learn to believe that it's solid and real and so on. And then, you know, all of a sudden there are these events which tear that illusion open, right? And when that happens, it's our impulse is to want to close it back up as quickly as possible. Sometimes we can't. You know, in 2016, we had the election of Mr. Trump, and that was a shock. You know, for many people, we had a department meeting the day after that, and some people at my department meeting really like distinguished people, you know, they could, one person said, you have to pardon me, I just can't speak today, right, you know. So it was just so shocking. You know, it's at moments like that, the illusion is torn open and we see that something is not real about what we've been calling reality. And we could say the same thing about events in the Middle East, you know, this week. You know, we have this this sort of agreement, like a gentleman's agreement, that this is real, and then suddenly something happens, and it becomes complicated quickly, right? It becomes complicated quickly, and it can cause enormous emotional distress, right? So, you know, on Facebook, you know, I noticed on Facebook that people were posting pictures of some of the people who were killed at that kibbutz. And the people were the sweetest looking people, right? Apparently this was a kibbutz that had an association with sort of like progressive or left-wing politics. They were having like a peace, a get-together dedicated to peace, like a little peace retreat. The people in the pictures are, you know, they're smiling, and they look very open, they have open faces. And you know, somebody in my network is Israeli, and he was posting these, and you would look at this picture of this young girl or this couple, this family, you know, basically the thought that these people had been killed was just, it wasn't just horrifying, you know, I found myself getting angry, right? It's just getting angry. You know, as I was scrolling down and these kept coming up, you know, it's like this person, you know, so clearly was blameless and, you know, just beginning his life or just beginning her life. I felt both sort of like it hurt my heart, you know, heartbreak. And I also felt angry, you know, and then, you know, if you've been on Facebook or if you've been reading the news, you know, you see these pictures of these Palestinians on the West Bank. And, you know, they look absolutely shell-shocked, right? Can you imagine what it's like to have explosions going off every couple of minutes and not know whether you're going to be dead or not in just a little while? They had an interview on NPR, and they were talking to these doctors in this Palestinian hospital, this West Bank hospital, and they were saying, you know, we can't leave, we're doctors. You know, one person said, you know, very noble human being, right? He said, look, I took an oath, you know, this is my job, I have to stay here. I'm running out of equipment, you know, we're gonna run out of gas in our generator or diesel fuel or propane, you know. But he said, you know, I have to stay here. And apparently a colleague of his had been killed, you know. So seeing this is so, you know, seeing this again, you know, heartbreak and anger, right? You know, both of those reactions. And, you know, there's this kind of cognitive dissonance, right? Kind of cognitive dissonance, because on the one hand, you know, so much of our cultural conditioning teaches us to find the good guy and find the bad guy, right? And that's really how we want to solve this problem. We want to say, okay, it's like, you know, if you have two kids and they're fighting, you say, now who started this, you know? And you know, our desire is to find the good guy and to find the bad guy. If only we can do that. But in a case like this, there's this cognitive dissonance, because in a certain way, I would say, you know, both sides are the good guys and both sides are the bad guys. And I realize that's an overgeneralization. I know that most people in the West Bank don't support Hamas, you know. And I know that, you know, many Israelis don't support the policies of Netanyahu, right? So there's lots of innocence on both sides, and there's lots of people who aren't innocent on both sides, you know. So we could spend a long time talking about the ethics of this, but I'm more interested today in a different kind of response, right? You know, a lot of time in our country, Zen and Buddhism is marketed as a way of calming yourself, right? Calming yourself. So, you know, basically, there's a very famous Zen teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh, and he was a wonderful person, right? And a deeply awakened person, really a genius, you know. And, you know, one of his teachings is, actually a book he wrote is called Being Peace. And you know, when something like this happens, when we're suddenly, this sort of incredible violence explodes in front of us, right? You know, it's easy to remember his book and think Being Peace. And you know, I need to be peace. I need to be with peace. And on NPR, I was listening on NPR, and there was this I guess it was a rabbi talking about, you know, basically conducting a service for people who were involved with this terrible event, and some of these people had lost daughters or sons, or family members in the initial murder. And he talked about, you know, just finding a place of stillness. He actually used the word stillness. He said, you know, there's nothing we can do right now, but we can find a place of stillness. And, you know, I thought that was so, I thought that was really wise, and, you know, great wisdom. You know, he said, I'm not in a position to end this conflict. And he said, these people are inconsolably sad, you know. And he also said that they're furious, right? And he said, you know, right now, what we need to do is find a place of peace. Or he said stillness, not peace, but stillness. You know, and that as I was listening to him, I was thinking, oh, that's a lot like teachings in Buddhism, right? Maybe he's even been influenced by Buddhism, you know, because he didn't make any references to future life or to you know, the law, to good. He didn't make any references to scripture. So you know, I thought, yeah, I understand. That's a very wise thing today, and I think it is. I think he's doing exactly the right thing. You know, when we find ourselves in these places where we're powerfully swept away by our reactions to things, you know, it really is important to be able to step out of those conditioned responses. And it's so hard when you're just caught up, especially if you're injured. I don't mean physically injured, but if you feel a sense of injury, or if you feel a sense of that, you know, somebody you love has been injured. You know, this outrage, sense of outrage at injustice is so powerful, right? And if you've been the target of that injustice, like righteous anger, right, it sweeps over you, you know, and these people were feeling both righteous anger and sadness. And, you know, being able to access that stillness is wonderful. I wonder how many of those people could access that stillness, you know, because it's not readily available to people, right? I mean, one of the things we do with Zen practice is we learn how to find that place of stillness. And it's as you know, everybody here has been practicing for some time, right? So you know how difficult it is at first to find that place of stillness. You know, even if everything in your life is going well and all things are lining up exactly as they should, you know, when you sit down on the cushion sometime, it's actually quite difficult. Your thoughts sweep you along. You have emotions, even if they're not powerful emotions, you know. And it takes a little time to find that place of stillness. It's like turning the dial on a radio and trying to find the station, right? And of course, the more you practice, the more easy it is to get to that place. And I do think that people who haven't had much practice, I'm not confident that many of the people in that congregation could find that place of stillness very easily, right? And you know, there was definitely quiet. You know, where he was, there were no shells going off and so on. So it might have been easier, but you know, we know how hard it is to find that place of stillness. And you know, many people think of meditation as stopping there, right? Stopping with that place of stillness. You know, so when we're hurting or when we're knocked off of our legs, off balance by events, when we feel we've been done an injustice, you know, those powerful emotions are relentless and don't easily release us. And when we get to a place of that place inside ourselves that is empty or still, you know, it gradually feels like liberation. It's so beautiful to experience that. You know, the Buddha used to use the metaphor of cold to describe himself, or cool. He used to use the metaphor of coolness. He would say, like, when you enter deep samadhi, it's like coming out of the boiling sun. Remember that the Buddha was in India, and stepping into the shadows where it's cool. And you know, he actually used to say, one of the ways he described his state of mental repose was, he said, I am cool or quenched. It's like, again, you know, you're thirsting and you drink water, and suddenly it's like release. So it's definitely the case that, you know, when we're in emotional distress and we can't find our feet, you know, being able to find that place of stillness is like stepping out of the blazing sun into the cool shade of a, you know, cool breeze and cool shade, or having cool water when you're really dying of thirst, right? But then what? See, then what? And that's where I think a lot of people's understanding of Buddhism stops, right? So when you've found that calm, cool place, that empty place, and you feel equilibrium, you know, you could say that's being peace. That is peace. See? But actually, I don't think that's peace. I think that's a cessation of hostilities, right? That's just stop the shooting, right? That's a cessation of hostilities. So you know, in the political sphere, you know, we could have a ceasefire, and I hope we do. Like, I hope we already do. And we could have the trucks from Egypt are already rolling into Gaza with supplies, water, and food. And so cessation of hostilities, right, isn't really the solution to the problem. It's not really peace. And that's true in our practice too. You know, just going to that calm, peaceful place is not liberation. Even though it feels like liberation and it's so wonderful, it's the beginning of our practice, not the end. You really aren't being peace until you've begun the hard work right? The hard work of encountering the difficulties that caused, that triggered all of these responses. Right. So, you know, when we have experiences that cause us, like, our hearts to hurt, right? Or, you know, naturally, you know, usually anger follows from that. And when that happens, our natural impulse is to recoil, is to get away. But, you know, actually, when we try to get away, we are making it impossible to resolve the problem. I deeply believe this. I think Zen is really convinced that this is, the Zen practice is based on the idea that this, you know, we have to engage with our obstacles, you know. And if we don't, we can't be peace. We can't be peace. It's not real. It's just the cessation of hostilities. So you know, when here's, you know, my wife, we have squirrels. We have a lovely backyard with lots of trees, and we have squirrels, right? And my wife loves the squirrels. You know, she actually throws peanuts out for the squirrels every morning. The jays come, and that's wonderful, right? The jays know we're going to throw peanuts out, and you can get a bag of peanuts, like this giant bag of peanuts, for $5 at Costco. They're roasted, unsalted peanuts, and it's a giant bag. So you can actually be kind of liberal with the peanuts, right? You know, because you could $5 a week or $5, you know, every couple of weeks on peanuts. You know, it's peanuts, right? So you know, basically we get up and throw these, and the jays all start screaming, and they come down and they eat the peanuts, and then the squirrels, who are adorable, right? You know, they hold the peanut in their little hands and they eat, you know. It's just heart, it's beautiful. You know, but you know, we also have fox, right? We fox. And you know, there have been times where we're having breakfast and we look out and there's the fox with a squirrel in his mouth, right? And the fox definitely loves the squirrels, right? I mean, I was washing dishes and the fox went by with a squirrel dangling, heading back to the den, right? So, you know, the fox eats the squirrels that we love. And it's possible, like, to say, you know, that is a bad fox, you know, but think about it. You know, the fox, you know, we've known that fox. That fox has been around. He's he's well known in the neighborhood. A lot of people love that fox. We actually leave an egg out every night for the fox. Foxes, as it turns out, love eggs. So every night, I take an egg and I put it in the same place, and the fox comes and Barbara has pictures of him picking up the egg and taking it back to the den. He doesn't eat it. He takes it back, right? So. One time we saw the couple, there's also like a female who's a little smaller than the male who makes the rounds, right? So, you know, we love the fox. We leave, even in the middle of winter, I never fail, right? I always put an egg out every night for the fox. And the fox comes and eats our squirrels, and we also feed the squirrels. And it's like, we love the squirrels and we love the fox, you know? And I know it really bothered my wife when the squirrel, one of her favorite squirrels, disappeared, right? I mean, it really hurt. It hurt. And, you know, basically, she knew this squirrel had interesting coloration on its tail, and the squirrel would practically come into the house, right? You know, the doors open, the peanuts are out on the steps, and the squirrel come in, got any peanuts, you know? So when the fox ate the must have eaten that squirrel. When it disappeared, we knew what had happened, you know, and it's possible to get angry at the fox, right? But we also love the fox. So there's this cognitive dissonance, right? You want to take sides. You want to say good guy and bad guy, and it hurts in both directions, right? It hurts in both directions. So one thing we could do is choose sides. We could say, that's it, you know, we're going to do something to get fox repellent or something like that, or maybe we don't really have animal control in Plainfield, fortunately, but we would never do something like that. But some people might. You might take sides, right? Or you'll see people who get upset. I mean, squirrels will eat all the seeds out of your bird's feeder. And you can say, oh, those, you know, people will try to foil them in various ways. If squirrels are very smart. You know, one way to solve the problem is to take sides, you know, but you know, that's actually not a good path, right? I mean, because, you know, both of these animals have to live. That without the eating squirrels, foxes don't have kids. You know, foxes maintain all kinds of ecological balance. You know, squirrels are amazing little creatures. So when it hurts, you know, we want to withdraw, but, you know, don't withdraw. You know, the interesting thing here, this is a koan about pilgrimages, right? So Feon is going on a pilgrimage. Dijong asks Feon, where are you going? And he said, I'm going on a pilgrimage. So, like, pilgrimage is a, like, we all know what pilgrimage is. It's saying, you know, I'm leaving New Jersey and I'm going to Nepal, or I'm going to Tibet, or, you know, Ladakh, let's say, in North India. So, you know, I'm going to take a plane, and then I'm going to, you know, take a jeep or a bus, and then I'm going to walk to this famous temple, and so on and so on. And you know, pilgrimages, please, you know, are wonderful things, right? You basically, what you're saying with a pilgrimage is, this place is sacred and holy, and this place is not as sacred and holy. So I'm not criticizing people who go on pilgrimages. It's a form of meditation, really. It's a practice. But what you're really saying is, this place is holy and this place is not holy. So you know, lots of people in Japan do this pilgrimage route in South Japan. It's famous. It's like you walk 600 miles. It's really beautiful. It's along the southern coast of Japan. And you can stay at temples. People stay at temples. They meditate a little bit. And then you could spend, you know, 600 miles. That's a long time. You could spend a summer doing that, right? And people do. And, you know, it's definitely a transformative experience for the people who do it. Very beautiful. But, you know, Dijong says, when Feon says, I'm going on a pilgrimage, Dijong says, well, why are you going on a pilgrimage? And Feon says, I don't know. See, so suddenly, Feon is sort of cast into this, he suddenly enters his don't know mind. And he realizes, I can't really say. And Dijong says, not knowing is nearest. You know, one way to interpret this is, you know, you don't have to go on a pilgrimage. You already are there when you're in your not knowing mind. Right? So not knowing is nearest. And I think it's also true that, you know, when we embrace the things that hurt us in our not knowing mind, we're on the path to, you know, we're on the pilgrimage. So you know, when things hurt us, we want to take sides instead of finding a bigger view, right? You know, when we experience something that hurts us, you know, we want a solution by choosing sides. But what we really need is to step outside of our box and enter like a bigger perspective, bigger horizon. See? And it doesn't have to be a war in the Middle East. It can be all kinds of things, you know. When I, when my brother, you know, just this is life, right? A friend of my wife's has cancer. He's just been diagnosed with cancer. He's going to go in for chemotherapy. And you know, basically, it's funny, you know, when something like that happens, I think all of us maybe, you know, we want to pull back a little bit, right? But actually, you know, when my wife went over to see her friend after he'd gotten this diagnosis, and they went out to lunch, right? She came back and she was just, you know, her friend may not be around in a year, right? It's really serious. It's like stage 4 cancer, prostate cancer, right? So it's spread a little bit. And, you know, my wife was so, this is a close friend of hers, somebody she worked with at one time, and you know, she was really, it was very hard for her, strangely, to go over to the house and see him. It was hard, because this is somebody she loves, she cares about, and has been her friend for 25 years. Hard to go over to the house. But when she went over to the house and she was over there with him, you know, they went out to lunch, their favorite place for lunch. And when she came back, she just felt, you know, she said, I feel so much better. I think if she had made, you know, contact, she had connected. And I also think it's like, I think the thought of losing her beloved friend was so terrifying, right? It's like, it makes perfect sense to me that it would be hard for her to go over and see somebody who's gotten this diagnosis. The thought of not, you know, she goes to lunch with this guy multiple times, you know, a week, and he's an older man whose partner died some time ago, and they have this wonderful friendship, my wife and this guy, you know, and I think it was so hard for her to go, but when she went, it's like getting close, don't go, don't step away, get closer to this experience, you know. This is your life now. This is your world now, you know. When she came back from that afternoon with him, she was just in such a better place. Nothing had changed, you know, he could die in a year, you know. He's going to go into this difficult chemotherapy regimen, he's going to lose, you know, all his hair and all this stuff. This is all going to happen to him. But she felt so, why did she feel better, right? I mean, she felt better, I think, because she connected with, like, the bigger picture. It's like stepping out of this little square into this bigger picture, right? You know, we're all going to die, right? That's going to happen. But, you know, she made contact with her friend, and it just opened up the world for her, right? It's like she's sharing with her friend this experience, and it's as though there was this mass of fear inside her, and that mass of fear just dissolved when she didn't step away, but she embraced it. And I've had this experience myself. You know, my brother was only 50 when he was diagnosed with blood, you know, bone cancer. And this was some time ago. They've gotten better at dealing with this, but, you know, it was, I really didn't want to go down to see him. It was just so hard to go down to see him because he was so sick. And I loved my brother, right? You know, it was so hard to be with that moment, be in that moment. But I had a similar experience, you know. When I was with my brother and he was in this condition, it was, first of all, it was just horrible, right? On one level, it was just horrible. You know, as he said, my whole house has become a hospital, right? You know, but on the other hand, it sounds weird to say, but there was something so wonderful about it. There was something so wonderful about it. You know, it was like all the obstacles to my loving my brother were out of the way, And it was just being there with the person, with a person I deeply loved, right? And it's like this wall just dissolves. And I think this is the essence of Zen practice. You know, the koan collection we normally use is called the Gate of No Barrier, or the Gateless Gate is how it's sometimes translated. You know, we find these things in life that generally involve some kind of a contradiction, right? So look, you know, in a certain sense, the people in Israel are right, I would say, and in a certain sense, the Palestinians are right, I would say, right? So I would say that, you know, it's a contradiction. There's this cognitive dissonance, because we want to say right, wrong, right? But it's very hard. They're both wrong in lots of ways, and they're both right in lots of ways, right? So this cognitive dissonance, you know, we want to get out of that by choosing a side. But, you know, the Zen path is not to take sides, and it's not to walk away, right? It's to embrace the situation. You know, all these koans work the same way. You know, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That's cognitive dissonance, right? It's cognitive dissonance. You know, I could go through the whole book and just read them, you know, and each one of these involves some kind of a insoluble contradiction, right? Einstein said something like, and I'll get this wrong, but he said something like, you know, problems can't be solved in the context in which they arose, something like that. You know, problems can't be solved using in the context where the problem arises. And what he really means is you have to invent a new kind of physics to do certain kinds of problems, right? That it's not just solving the problem, it's seeing the problem in a new way. And I think Zen practice is all about that. It's about feeling boxed in, trapped in a contradiction. And then, you know, you say, if I go this way, bad. You know, if I go this way, something else is wrong, you know. And when you don't know what to do, A is wrong and B is wrong, but you only can choose between A and B, you suddenly step into this larger, it's like the barrier becomes a door, or the door dissolves and you step into a bigger world. That's the essence of Zen practice. And what I would say is that, you know, actually, it's only possible to have peace on the other side of that conflict. You know, it's only by going into the contradiction, and not by choosing sides, and not by trying to evade it, right? But it's only by going into the contradiction that we can be peace. And I think we experience that in Zen all the time. You know, working on a koan involves, like, you want to say yes or no, right or wrong, up or down, and you soon realize that none of those are satisfactory answers. And then you just have to sort of drift for a while. It's like you have this period of just being empty and open. And then in that empty openness, something presents itself that you couldn't have imagined in a million years. Right? You couldn't have imagined in a million years. And you come into the teacher and you give an answer that doesn't even make sense to you because it's so new. It's coming from a different place, right? And the teacher might say, oh, that's wonderful. Exactly. And you've stepped out of a little box and you've stepped into the big box. So, you know, being peace is not simply calming the mind and getting to a place where there's no longer immediate emotional distress. And in fact, when you're working through life problems, on or off the cushion, emotional distress is part of life. It's part of koan practice too. You know, I've had koans where I'm so mad. I remember doing this one koan, and I was so mad, I just felt like throwing my cushion at Genki Roshi. And I went in and I said, I'm really hopping mad. And he burst into laughter. You know, it was like, you know, I thought he would be, you know, he's been there, right? You know, it's just, you know, a few weeks ago I said it's not realistic to expect that your Zen practice will make you happy all the time. And it's also not realistic to imagine that, like, the Dalai Lama watching, looking at pictures of people from a kibbutz who have been murdered would not feel anything at all. See, I have to tell you, I don't believe that's true. If Buddhism produced people like that, they would be of no value to anybody, right? They would be robots, right? Right? That would be like a robot. So you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, that when the Dalai Lama looks at pictures like that, it hurts his heart. See. And I'm pretty sure that when the Dalai Lama looks at pictures of those, you know, I saw this picture of this poor Palestinian kid. Oh my God, he was all by himself and he was covered with dirt and he was crying. He was like, oh my God. I don't believe that the Dalai Lama looks at that in his, you know, like, ah, serenity, right? That would be monstrous, right? That would not be compassion. You know, compassion means you look at those pictures and you want to cry, right? And the problem is, you know, people feel so overwhelmed by their powerful emotions, they don't know how to handle them. And then there's this impulse to you know, just give me justice and somebody's going to pay for this, right? And as soon as we fall into that retributive mindset, right, we're in the wrong place. We're in the wrong place. And we're also in the wrong place when we do want to disown it. We want to say, oh, this is not involving me. This is not me, right? This is somebody else. Everybody has their own karma. You know, that's also, in my opinion, my humble opinion, I think that's incorrect. I don't know if you've ever read the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, many people who like Asian culture read the Bhagavad Gita, and they don't read it carefully, because actually there's a scene in the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna has to go to war with his kinsmen. They're having a civil war. And Arjuna is so distressed by the prospect of having to go to war that he kind of has a nervous breakdown. And when he has a nervous breakdown, he sees God, and God says, your job is to be a soldier. And your job is to do your job, your duty as a soldier. Go into the war and fight, and I will decide who wins. Now, that is in the Bhagavad Gita. Please do not follow that advice. See, Buddhism and Hinduism are very different religions, if I may say so. You know, that is not the Dharma. That is not the Buddha's way. We do not take sides, right? We do not take sides. As soon as you're in the taking sides mentality, we all fall into that place, but that is not Buddhism. We have to step out of the box where conflict becomes inevitable. We have to work through the barriers that separate us from other people. And we have to enter a new world where those barriers don't exist. That's the Dharma. That's the Buddha's Dharma. So this is very hard to do, as a matter of fact. But what do you think we're doing on the cushion all this time, right? I mean, in the Buddha's own time, he had to contend with this. You know, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, the sutra that describes the Buddha's death, you know, he's involved in stopping a war. A king consults him and says, what do you think about there were people called the Vajis. And the Vajis were actually a lot like the Shaka people, the Buddha's family, the Buddha's tribe. And the king says, what do you think about my going to war with the Vajis? And the Buddha dissuades him. He says, you know, that would be a really bad idea. It's for one thing, he said, the Vajis are really courageous, hardworking, diligent, and united people, and you probably won't win, right? But he really tries to dissuade the king, you know. So, you know, in the Buddha's time too, you know, taking sides is not the answer. It's showing people another way, a bigger way, right? That's being peace. And so, you know, nearness is the path. You know, not knowing is nearest, and drawing close is the path, is the way. It's true that in the middle of these emergencies, you know, we're so overwhelmed we have to go to that place of stillness. But once we're in that place of stillness, once we're in that place of empty calm, you know, the work is not done, the work is just beginning. Now we have to engage with what hurts our feelings, right? It's like sitting, you know, when my brother was dying of cancer, you know, I have to sit with that, you know, and you feel so angry. It's like, so this is so wrong, this is so unfair, you know. If only there were a God so I could hate him, right, you know. But at some point, you know, you go to that still place and all of that dissolves, and suddenly you realize this is what I must do, right? This is what I have to do. And in that case, it's just be available and express love, right? Just be available and express. That's what I could do under those. I'm not a surgeon, I'm not a oncologist, you know. I can be present, I can hold somebody up, I can tell them that I love them. That's a good idea, right? It's a good way to respond to a situation, you know. So being peace is not so easy, but it's so important to engage with what we're struggling with every day in matters big and small, right? Matters big and small. We want to withdraw, but don't withdraw. You know, go to that place of stillness, and then the work is to engage. The work is to engage. The profound talk, entering into the noumenon, decides threes and weeds out four. The great way to the capital goes seven ways across and eight ways up and down. Suddenly, if you can open your mouth and explain fully, take steps and walk, then you can hang your ball and bag up high and break your staff. Tell me, who is this? So the point of that is, look, in life we don't know what to do, right? You know, you can go right or you can go left. You know, you can be pro or you can be against, and so on, right? Seven ways across and eight ways up and down. Basically, that's our dilemma. We're always in a contradiction, right? Always in a contradiction. They're right, but wrong. They're right, but wrong. Dijong asks Feon, where are you going? Feon said, around on a pilgrimage. Dijong said, what's the purpose of the pilgrimage? Feon said, I don't know. Dijong said, not knowing is nearest. Verse. Now, having studied to the full, it's like before. Having shed entirely the finest thread, he reaches peace. Now, he reaches peace, not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long, stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. This is the big mind, right? Level. The abundance of scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes where his feet take him, always offering help, right? Always helping. The purpose of 10 years pilgrimage, clearly he turned his back on one pair of eyebrows.